Voltei desconectada.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
All right, then. We are live. So my plan this week is to continue on from next week. No, last week. I'm getting my time out of sequence. Man, I should never have paid for that Time Machine subscription sometime back in 2025. Still confusing myself. Okay. So, and there is, in fact, Tim from Berlin has just connected to SDF comm chat in the Anon radio room. Because I actually am going to start with a news story from Berlin. So, on Sunday, there was a technical problem at a coal-fired power station in Berlin, which interestingly is owned by Vattenfall, which I always think of as the Swedish State Power Board. It's probably been privatized by now, just like everything else in the world, but that's the way I still think of it. Anyway, the result of this power outage was that the district heating system in a large chunk of eastern Berlin was affected, so something like 50,000 households worked out to something like 130,000 individuals were without heat or hot water for 13 hours. And there's been a lot of consternation about this. I was reading, I use Google Translate for this because I'm too lazy to really try to bull my way through the German, but I was reading a piece in the Berliner Zeitung by a guy, one of their opinion commentators, I guess, Gunnar Schupelius, who was talking about heating. And so basically saying that the Energiewende is not only failing to, supply electricity from wind and solar the way it claims, but can't do anything about heat. Yes, Schupelius Erger, which I guess is opinions or what have you, same root, I guess, as English argument. Anyway, and basically complaining that the people in charge of energy policy in Germany have not actually been making policies that are fit for purpose. Anyway, and given what I had just read, so if you tuned in to Hear Now the Words on Friday, you heard me reading from The Uses of Atomic Energy in the GDR for the Economic and Social Development. So I wrote to, I sent an email, obviously, to Mr. Schupelius with a subject, Fernwärme ohne fossilen Energieträger, or district heating without fossil fuels, essentially. And then I began by saying, I hope you'll pardon me if I continue in English. Your piece in the BZ, dated 13 January, reminded me of an episode in Berlin history. About 1960, as political tensions between the USA and USSR ran high, there was concern about a possible second Berlin blockade. To avoid a recurrence of the bizarre situation of carrying coal by air freight, in which case, of course, the fuel value of the aviation fuel burned was considerably greater than that of the coal, it was proposed to construct a nuclear power station at Tempelhof. Of course, the typical nuclear unit requires fueling only every year or so, making it ideal for waiting out a blockade, and the mass of the fuel is no more than 1/10,000th of the coal required to produce the same heat, so new fuel could, realistically, be brought in by air. Ah, Tin corrects me and says it's more like Schupelius's annoyances, whatever he's mad about. There used to be a radio program in Dallas where, you know, it was, I don't know, Bobby Joe, somebody anyway, and the show would always begin with someone asking, "What are you mad about this week, Bobby Joe?" Anyway, matter of fact, when in 1958, Bennett Lewis of AECL was speaking to the electricity people in British Columbia, pointed out that if nuclear fuel for a power plant near Vancouver had to be flown in from St. John's, Newfoundland, it would only add as much to the overall cost of electricity as the cost of transporting hydropower 250 kilometers over high voltage lines. Anyway, it is therefore somewhat surprising that, so far as I know, the only place in Germany where a municipal heating system was supplied from a nuclear power station was at Greifswald in the then DDR. The connection to the Bruno-Leuschner station, 22 kilometers away, was made on 27 December 1983. According to an official publication I have here, this was done to save the cost of imported heating oil. You may have heard that, in the autumn of 2019, the municipal heating system of Budovice in the Czech Republic was connected to the nuclear station at Temelin. This was estimated to save some 70,000 tons of coal a year. Likewise, the Swiss station at Betznau has supplied heat to a local network since 1983, which is estimated to save about 14 million cubic meters of gas annually. And of course, we should not forget the original combined heat and power project at Augusta in Sweden, which operated from 1964 to 1972. It was taken out of service for being uneconomical in comparison to oil heat. In the winter of 1972-73, people complained bitterly of the nuisance of heating oil smoke. The next winter, they complained a lot more when their heating bills were four times higher. Of course, nuclear power is not completely free from occasional interruptions of the kind which happened last Sunday. Nuclear stations, however, do experience such outages much more rarely, owing to the very high technical standards required of them. In fact, in February of 2021, Darlington Unit 1 in Ontario, Canada, was taken offline as scheduled after being continuously on power for 1,106 days. Which I just keep talking about because I find it really, really impressive. And no, I still haven't found out whether the Budovice Brewery takes its heat from the district heating system. I would much like to know that. Anyway, so that's just a little note. But I was going to talk about something entirely different. I'm sort of following on from last week's show, which was about sex. Now, last week I talked a lot about reproduction, which is only fair, given that, you know, on a biological basis, sex would not exist if not for the necessity of reproduction. But when we come to consider human beings, the plain fact is, A, that sexual behavior as such is not necessarily related to reproduction at all. There are a lot of what are considered fairly popular sex practices which have no reproductive function whatsoever. But quite aside from that, there are a lot of other things that are wound up in sex, right? There are a lot of things which are complex, right? That it can be said, for example, that virtually every human society has different roles in general for male and female members of society. On the other hand, just exactly what is considered men's versus women's social role varies enormously from society to society. There are a few things, right, which are relatively constant, that in most societies, you know, if there's something very dangerous, then usually it's considered men's work, because essentially if you had two societies and one had a rule like that and the other one didn't, the birth rate of the one that didn't would probably be considerably lower, and it would tend to die out. But what exactly is considered a man's role versus a woman's role varies very much from society to society. And similarly, of course, there have always been individuals who have blurred those lines or crossed them or what have you. And this gets me to thinking about Joan of Arc, and that has me making a much broader point. And I'm sorry, it's going to take me a minute to get around to this because this is really very strange. But a lot of the things I talk about on this show are really very strange, so I think you're accustomed to that by now. Now, Jeanne d'Arc was, of course, a French girl who led a sort of popular-ish revolt to void a treaty between the King of France and the King of England, which made the King of England's heir the heir to the King of Kingdom of France in place of the natural heir of the King of France, who, by all accounts, was a pretty awful person, but nobody really cared about that at the time, I think. It was essentially nationalistic, I think, in character. You could call it that anyway. First outbreak of the kind of nationalism which led eventually to the French Revolution. But it had a strong religious component for several reasons. One was, of course, that Jeanne herself claimed that she had been instructed in visions by angels of God to lead a crusade to throw the English out of France. It was also somewhat religious in character because the treaty between the King of England and the King of France, on which the whole matter turned, was accepted and enforced by the bishops of the Catholic Church. And thereby hangs a tale. It's also important because a main objective of this was to get the Dauphin, the heir of the King of France, to the cathedral at Reims, the seat of St. Remigius, who in quasi-legendary times baptized Clovis, King of the Franks, right? To get him to the cathedral of Reims so that he could then be anointed as heir to the Kingdom of France, which was a very important distinction at the time. Tobe wonders where in Germany he'd find the best pretzels. Bretzen is very much Bavarian, and so the answer is probably not Rieschart in downtown Munich. It's probably Oberammergau or someplace like that. But yes, pretzels, very, very Bavarian. Anyway, but where was I? Oh yes, Joan of Arc. Now, Joan of Arc was captured by the English, and then taken and tried before a panel of bishops. Again, why bishops? Well, the answer is that bishops were basically the guarantors of the treaty between the King of England and the King of France. They were responsible for overseeing enforcing violations on either side. Anyway, and she was convicted, among other things, of heresy. Now, on what grounds was she convicted of heresy? Well, the judgment of the court was that she had committed a heresy, in other words, a violation of the teachings of the church, by dressing in men's clothing. Now, I have a passing familiarity with the doctrines and teachings of the Holy Roman Catholic Church. And I can tell you right now, there's no such thing, all right? There is no such thing. Because, of course, for one thing, the Roman Catholic Church is an organization which is very extensive in time and space. And it's well known that what is considered a man's dress in one time and place may be considered a woman's dress in another time and place. That in classical Rome, or immediately post-classical Rome, for example, trousers were regarded as very much a thing for women, not for men. Why, I'm not sure, considering they've been adopted from the Parthians, nothing to do with Parthenon, Persians, who were very, very effective horseback archers, but because they didn't have stirrups, they had to shoot their arrows and then turn around and run far away. Anyway, that's not what's important here. What's important is essentially that the language of the decision, really, honestly, not only does it have no grounding that I can find in the doctrines and teachings of the Holy Roman Catholic Church, it actually smacks somewhat of heresy itself. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, they seemed, the bishop's decision, the way it reads, would give you the impression that being female is something like leprosy. It's a hideous condition, which should not be spoken of if at all possible, and in any case, someone who's afflicted with it should be required to wear distinctive garments so that all good, right-thinking people can keep away. Now, where does this come from? Now, you might immediately think that it comes from the Jewish ritual purity and the horror of any kind of blood flowing from the body, right, which leads to, for example, you know, a horror of menstruation. But that turns out not to work. Because, among other things, the bishops at the trial actually took evidence which showed that Joan of Arc did not, in fact, menstruate, which is not surprising considering that she fasted a lot and engaged in heavy physical activities a lot of the time. This is not surprising at all. No, I say that this lays the bishops themselves open to suspicion of heresy for the following reason. There's something called the Wisdom of Silenus, which comes down to us from classical antiquity, and it's a form of fundamental pessimism. Silenus was a satyr. Here's the thing, satyrs, of course, they don't do much except get drunk and have sex. You wouldn't think that satyrs would be pessimistic, but Silenus was a satyr and the teacher of Bacchus, the god of wine and drunkenness and carousing and revelry. And Bacchus asked Silenus, this is how the myth goes, Bacchus asked Silenus, what is the best thing in life? What is the great wisdom that you have learned? And Silenus said, you're not going to want to hear this. And Bacchus says, tell me, teacher, what is the great truth? And Silenus says, it is better to die than to live, and better yet is never to have been born at all. So both in the philosophy of classical antiquity and in many religions around the world, the Eastern religions, Buddhism, for example, this kind of pessimism is deeply embedded. The idea that it is better to die than to live, and better still, never to have been born at all. Because the world is simply the place of suffering. Buddhism supposes that the world is not especially real, and the suffering you experience is essentially in your mind, and that in Orthodox Buddhism, and I'm sure Northern Lights will be mad about my description of this, but that's life. Orthodox Buddhism seeks the annihilation of the self because the self itself is nothing but suffering and illusion, which is, you know, blah. Anyway, but there's a very strong strain of this in a lot of religious and philosophical traditions, but notably not really in Christianity. Now, I have to qualify this, right? Because, of course, medieval Christianity very much saw the world as a place of suffering because, I mean, to be frank, it was. You know, I mean, down to the beginning of the 20th century, pretty much even in the wealthiest parts of the world and among the wealthiest people in the world, you had 20 to 30% infant mortality, 10 to 20% maternal mortality, all kinds of that thing. You know, life was pretty awful, and it didn't necessarily last very long. And so, you know, it's not surprising that if you, you know, think of the great medieval prayers, many of them speak of, you know, mourning and weeping in this valley of tears, and after this our exile, and this, that, or the other thing, right? Well, suffice to say that that's still not a fundamental principle of Christianity. Fundamental principle of Christianity, well, we start with Genesis, right, where it says, right at the beginning, God looked upon all that he had created and saw that it was good. And you go to the other end, to the New Testament, to the specifically Christian scriptures, and you get told things like, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say, rejoice. you know, and in between you have, yes, you do have Ecclesiastes, right? Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity and a striving after wind. But you also have, this is the day that the Lord has made, let us rejoice and be glad in it, right? So that's something to think about. It's much easier to be an optimist in this day of vaccines and power machinery than it was in the days of plague and slavery, although apparently some people feel that plague is just all right with them, not me. But nevertheless, Christianity, I think, has a fundamentally optimistic character about what I would call the visible world. And this is pointed out, for example, very sharply in the book of Revelation, where the heaven and the earth are destroyed, right? But not to give way to a realm of pure spirit. They are instead replaced with a new heaven and a new earth, which are basically all the things that the heaven and the earth were supposed to be in the first place but never quite lived up to. And the dead are raised in physical bodies of some kind, very different undoubtedly to the ones that we know in this world of impermanence and suffering. But nevertheless, so there's a glorious physical reality in which we participate gloriously and physically. And that's very much taken up by Thomas Aquinas, who is the great theologian of the Middle Ages. And you might say down to the present time. All right, so what does this have to do with anything? Well, as I say, there are many religions sort of outside Christianity which did not embrace this idea, and some of them, and this is very important, some of them wound up using the terminology and the ideas of Christianity to some extent and became identified not as separate religions but as heretical sects of Christianity. And so the most important of these is Gnosticism. Gnosticism is not really a form of Christianity. It's really a separate religion or set of religions or philosophical systems, which happened to originate about the same time as Christianity, and which, growing up in the same environment, often found it convenient to adopt terms and ideas out of Christianity, especially because, you see, Gnostics, the fundamental idea of Gnosticism is that the universe, the tangible, visible universe, is not the creation of God. It's the creation of something called the Demiurge, who's either an evil or a stupid or a defective God, right? And that you have to liberate yourself from physical existence through knowledge. And this idea, of course, in Christianity, drawn from the Jewish tradition of the wisdom of God as something like a separate being. You know, the greatest cathedral, the greatest church in Christendom for 1,000 years or so was the Hagia Sophia, the Church of Holy Wisdom. Not Saint Sophia, as it's sometimes called, but the Church of Holy Wisdom in Constantinople. And it's generally agreed that, at least in the pre-exilic period, and possibly after that, that the wisdom of God was worshipped in the temple in Jerusalem as a, at least, quasi-separate entity, as reflected, for example, in the biblical Book of Wisdom. Anyway, so the Gnostics glommed onto this Sophia and the idea of a Christos as something really a useful set of terminology for them, even though, as I say, it really had separate origins from Christianity and was a separate thing, because there were also schools of Gnosticism which didn't use Christian terminology, didn't do that kind of thing, right? Wouldn't be mistaken for a form of Christianity, as it were. And of course, there's a great deconstruction of all of this in Irenaeus' 5 books, generally called Against the Heresies, but their formal title is Refutation and Overthrow of the Knowledge Falsely So Called, because knowledge, or gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, is the key concept of Gnosticism, that there's some piece of knowledge which you can gain which will allow you to liberate yourself from the tangible world with all its imperfections and suffering and the cycle of death and rebirth. And a great example of this sort of non-Christian Gnosticism is Manichaeism, which is a Persian religion from about the 2nd century AD. Mani was a Persian prophet who had a Manichaean, you know, his followers, the religion of Manichaeism, are very much in the Gnostic tradition, but with a lot more sort of mystical rather than the philosophical elements of Western Gnosticism. Anyway, there is probably a bridge there to some schools of Buddhism, particularly Mahayana-type schools of Buddhism. I don't know. I'm not an expert on this. Handy C would probably be able to tell you more. Certainly, we know that there were Christian and Gnostic sects which migrated to Central Asia and came in contact with the people there. Anyway, in fact, it's sometimes been claimed that Red Hat Lamaism comes out of Nestorian Christianity. The Nestorians being a sect of actual Christian heretics, people who had a different idea than the Orthodox idea, who wound up sort of being exiled from the Roman Empire. Anyway, so Manichaeism is not an example of the traditional Persian dualism, but it does draw some of those elements, the idea of the opposition of a bad god, except the demiurge is less than a real god, right? And so this physical existence is only the creation of the demiurge and not of the real God. And you're trying to reach the realm of the real God, which is the realm of pure spirit. Now, what does this have to do with Joan of Arc? Well, the answer is that for people who believe that being born is the greatest misfortune that can possibly happen to a person, for people who believe that we are souls trapped in an insufficient or even evil existence, it is not uncommon, then, that their belief system and their system of thought takes on a horror of muliebrity, that the idea of the female being the agency of birth and thus of the trapping of divine souls in fallen matter, right, this is a bad thing. And, you know, the whole Gnostic concept sort of collapses, you know, it is washed away in the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance, although the revival of classical antiquity certainly does bring back things like the thought of the wisdom of Silenus, and you have the Protestant Reformation and this and that, you get René Descartes, and Descartes comes up with a different, right, Descartes comes up with a different matter-spirit duality, essentially. Right, in which he privileges the intellect essentially and regards, as opposed to the medieval Christian theologians who saw the human person as a unity of spirit, mind, and body, in which the spirit and mind can only act through the body and can only perceive through the body, and so our experience and being is very much corporeal. Descartes comes along and once again wrenches the soul and the body apart. All because he was suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning during the 30 Years' War. But, you know, I mean, if you read his discourse, it's very clear that he was shut up in a little cottage with a coal stove burning and suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning. Anyway, but so the important thing that I have to say here about all of that is just that whether or not you see the existence we are in as real and important really shapes how you behave in the world. And now, of course, we have a new kind, I'd be inclined to call it almost a new Gnosticism, right? Because you look at things like, I mean, you see Mark Zuckerberg and his big, you know, video advertisement for the metaverse, in which you can divorce yourself from physical reality. You know, there is an episode of that TV show Black Mirror involving, you know, people transferring their consciousness into computers. And, you know, this is the thing, right? That this kind of millenarian divorce of consciousness from corporeality is so embedded in our discourse today. So this concept keeps arising and arising and arising. And I genuinely think, right, cryptocurrency people who don't care about the emissions or associated with electric power and about the, frankly, the trouble it causes in the world when you're using that energy and using a bunch of other stuff for this purpose, rather than for purposes that actually benefit people, I genuinely think that a lot of that comes out of this whole concept of decorporealization. That ever and again, this decorporealization becomes a key element of human thought. So we had Gnosticism, we had Cartesianism, and now we have, you know, digital raptureism, right? You know, this is the Kurzweilian singularity as religion, essentially. Anyway, in 15 seconds is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. which, you know, probably is corporeal in some way, shape, or form. And you have been listening to it on radio.net, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix system. Thank you for listening.
7.